Ruben and all of his crew have been working with us over the last 2.5 years. We recently had some electrical damage in the building, which took down the entire network. And they were in helping us the next day. It was a real, real pleasure working with them. It helped us out a ton. Here at Vermont College, we're a small operation. Our IT department, we only have 2 people. So it's often hard sometimes to find the right bit of knowledge that we might need. So I have actually called Ruben before and spoke with them about, you know, things that I'm trying to do, things that I'm trying to accomplish. And they've been very helpful in guiding us along the way. Friendly, courteous, knowledgeable are the first 3 words that come to my head when I think about Ruben and everyone there. And they're a great, great crew.
RB Technologies cares about their customers. Call them at 223-4448 or online at rbtechvt.com. RB Technologies, efficiency through technology.
All right, we head to the phone. Joining us live on the line, let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to political analyst Eric Davis, retired from Middlebury College. Good morning, Eric. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Mark.
How's it going?
Very good. We have a sunny day this morning for the first time in several days. That's nice.
Yeah, always like that. Always like that. Weekend looking not so great, but that's all right. It's all right. So the big news this week, it seems as though in the political races, some money reports come in, and it looks like Scott Milne's actually been, or somebody in the Milne campaign's actually been picking up the phone and dialing for dollars, raised about $80,000. He's back in the ballgame, right, Eric?
I'm afraid not, Mark. Scott Milne has raised more money in the September reporting period than he did in the campaign today. But if you look at that $80,000, that comes to about $20,000 a week. And Peter Shumlin has over $1 million in the bank. Shumlin continues to raise money, mostly from businesses and wealthy individuals. If you look at previous campaigns, my sense is that for a gubernatorial candidate to be competitive, that candidate needs to be spending about $500,000 in the last 2 months of the campaign between Labor Day and Election Day. And that comes to somewhere between $50,000 and $70,000 a week. And you need that to pay for broadcast ads on television and radio, to pay staff members, to maintain your web presence, social media, and postage and printing for mailings and other publicity materials. Scott Milne's campaign is doing better in the fundraising than it was in the summer, but it's still able to spend only about $20,000 a week. And that is really below what in previous cycles a gubernatorial campaign has spent to be competitive. Now, there have been some candidates who've spent over $1 million. At some point, spending, there's the law of diminishing returns comes in. But Milne's problem right now is that he has very little money to pay for paid advertising, so he has trouble getting his message out. And in my view, he has not been effectively using free media in order to make up for his difficulties in buying paid media. He does not hold many press conferences. He does not do events that will attract press coverage. And without the coverage, his name doesn't appear in the newspapers or on news websites. His voice doesn't appear on the radio. His picture doesn't appear on TV.
Do you think he's doing this deliberately?
I think he has raised as much money as he is capable of at this point. And I'll tell you why, Mark. If you look at some of the other financial reports that came in, Phil Scott is on pace to raise over $200,000. And I'll be interested, in fact, to see by Election Day whether Phil Scott actually raises more money than Scott Milne. Mm-hmm. And the second is the House Republican leader, Don Turner, held a press conference with some of his legislative candidates earlier this week. And I've been looking at the legislative races the past few days, and I think there are some winnable seats for Republicans, and they could make some small gains. You know, we're not talking about huge numbers, but maybe half a dozen seats or so. And my sense is that the sort of traditional Republican donors are more interested this cycle in giving either to Phil Scott, who's the incumbent, or to legislative candidates who have a chance of winning than to Scott Milne's campaign. The wealthy individuals and the larger businesses, Shumlin has those locked up in terms of financial support. But I think some of the people who've traditionally given to Republican gubernatorial candidates in the past are focusing on Phil Scott in legislative races rather than Scott Milne this year.
Mm-hmm. But this question about not holding public events or drawing a lot of free media, do you think Scott Milne's doing that deliberately so that he doesn't take positions, doesn't offend anybody?
I think there's two things going on. One is it's been very difficult for him to come up with positions. Now, I think that reflects, one, his lack of political experience. He's never been in the legislature, never had to had to deal with these matters in public office before. Second, the Republicans have very little staff capability. Once Jim Douglas's term as governor was over, the administration, which used to provide Republican candidates with ideas, that's all gone. So the Republicans have a tough time coming up with ideas. So I think that's one of the reasons. But I think this also reflects that Milne doesn't have a campaign strategist. Now, some people say campaign strategists just spout the conventional wisdom, and candidates ending up paying them a lot just to hear the conventional wisdom. And there may be something to that. But I think if Milne did have a campaign manager who was an experienced Vermont political operative, that manager would be telling Milne to hold at least one press conference a week in order just to get his name in the paper and his voice and his face on the broadcast media.
Mm-hmm. The last time you and I spoke, which was just a couple of weeks ago, you raised the question and said you really didn't think Peter Shumlin was going to break the 50% mark.
Yeah, now I think he will for two reasons. One, he laid on a massive advertising blitz the last couple of weeks. He spent over $200,000 on broadcast ads since Labor Day. And that's a lot of money for an incumbent, that's a lot of money. And the advertisements are the traditional incumbent strategy. You know, I've been in office for 4 years. Times were tough at the beginning. Things are getting better. Reelect me to continue the progress that we started in the last 4 years. Interestingly, in fact, Mark, I was just looking at some British political advertisements that the Conservative Party, the governing party, put out there. They've been in office 5 years. Shumlin's been in office four. But the themes of the two advertising campaigns are nearly identical. Keep us in office to continue what we've started. We can't take the risk of making a change. And that's Shumlin's argument.
Mm-hmm.
The other reason I think Shumlin will now clear the 50% threshold is Dan Feliciano seems to be really struggling. I thought after the Republican primary, when he got 15%, he might be able to build on that, you know, raise enough money to do some broadcast ads, get a bit of momentum, and maybe have a high single digit, even up possibly as much as a 10% vote share. He's raised hardly any money in September. He's really not been visible except at the two debates that have been held that month, although he did hold one press conference. And I think Feliciano now looks more in the traditional third-party territory of 3 to 5%. So, you know, 2 years ago, Peter Shumlin had 57%, Randy Brock had 37, a 20-point margin. I think we're now looking at more like a 10 to 15% margin with Shumlin in the low 50s, Milne around 40%, Feliciano maybe 3 to 5, and the other candidates a handful of votes each.
After you and I spoke the last time, Scott Milne called into this program and accused me of practicing journalistic malpractice by putting you on, and said that your numbers are going all over the place in terms of how he'll finish, that you've had as much as a 10-point spread from the beginning of this race. Can you address that?
Okay, so he says that my numbers have been all over the place?
Yeah, that the numbers...
I mean, the campaign, the numbers change over the course of the campaign, and I would not disagree with that king. I don't think I've ever had him within 10%. I can't recall any discussion with you or any other media organization where I thought Milne would have closer than 10% to Shumlin. I think, you know, sometimes, in my view, the gap has been 10, sometimes it's been 20, but I think it's been in those parameters.
And is a 10-point drift in the course of a pretty short campaign, is that acceptable?
By drift, you mean closing the gap?
No, I mean your numbers changing.
Yeah,
your analysis changing.
I think so. I've never told you or anyone else that I think Shumlin would not finish first. I never told you or anyone else that I thought Milne would do much better than 40%. Sometimes I thought Milne has been in the mid to low 30s. Sometimes now I think he may be closer to 40. Shumlin, I thought, might be high 40s, mid 50s, but... I think those are the ranges I've been in terms of projections ever since the middle of the summer.
Well, one more question on Scott Milne before we take some calls here. Yesterday,
sure,
he went to the Woodstock Union High School.
Yep.
And I thought to myself, why would you be speaking to high school students?
I wondered that, too. Most of the people in his audience were not registered to vote because they're not old enough to vote. Now, maybe he thought he'd get some news coverage out of it. And he did get an article in the Valley News, which was picked up by some other media, VT Digger, among others. That one's hard to explain. I mean, I thought... You know, and again, you know, Scott Milne and I obviously disagree about what what the strategy should be. My thought on reading that story and then seeing another story that came out yesterday with the feds, it came out that the federal government came down on Vermont Health Connect and told the state in rather no uncertain terms in early September they needed to either fix it up or take it online because it wasn't up to the federal security standards for interaction with the federal data hub.
Mm-hmm.
My reaction on reading that story is rather than campaigning with high school students in Woodstock, Scott Milne should have gone to Montpelier, where there are media, and it's not that hard to organize a press conference, and held an event lambasting the Shumlin administration for incompetent management of Vermont health care, for not being transparent with the citizens of the state about the problems with Vermont Health Connect, and having no firm plan for getting Vermont Health Connect fixed by the time the next enrollment cycle begins in November. And I think he could have got much more mileage out of that than talking to high school students in Woodstock.
Let's take a couple of calls. Let's begin in Walden. Michael, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Like Tony, the previous caller, I want to connect your previous topic with what's going on here. Imagine in Hong Kong, if we were watching the election in Hong Kong, if we found out that the same political analyst was giving his opinions on the TV, on the radio, and the newspaper all over Hong Kong, and saying the same thing, basically that the incumbents have all the power and all the money, and the incumbents are going to win. We would say that's really, that kind of stinks. We probably call it bias. I know you really get your hackles up, Mark, when media bias is brought up. But if you'd rather, why don't we call it media laziness? Why is it that Eric Davis is on VPR, is on WDEV, is on Channel 3, is on VT Digger? We get nothing else other than Eric Davis telling us that basically the power elite has all the power and is going to continue to win. Until we start focusing on issues and get out of this paradigm, we're stuck. We're absolutely stuck. Let's talk about real issues. Let's talk about how the Shumlin administration people are either, you know, getting jobs with lobbying firms or Green Mountain Power. Let's talk about how people out here are suffering. Enough of this.
Okay. Well, we can certainly talk about that.
Can you find another political analyst?
Well, you know, if you got any recommendations, I'm all ears, Michael.
Again, we'll get back to political laziness. You're a journalist.
Okay.
You guys should be digging. You guys should be finding different points of view. You guys should be challenging. The Fourth Estate used to challenge politicians. Now you go to cocktail parties with them. Now VT Digger has cocktail parties and celebrations with lobbyists and politicians. That's not journalism. That's being part of the power elite. That's the problem.
Thank you for your call. I would make this point. I have Eric Davis on this program because I think he's a good political analyst. Other media outlets, if they decide to also call Eric, I have no control over that. I run my program. That's it, my friend. And as far as the difference between this country and Hong Kong, I would dare say that in a lot of places in the world, you can't call into a program like this and complain. Eric, anything you want to address on that?
I'll just make two points. First of all, in terms of other political analysts, earlier this year, Channel 3 was also using Mike Smith, who had been an official in the Douglas administration and a longtime person involved in politics, and his perspective did differ from mine in some instances. He's now the president of Burlington College, so it's not available for political analyst work anymore, but Mike Smith was doing political analysis earlier this year also.
Yeah, Chris Graff was doing some for a period of time, and people like Michael and others complained that because he was now working at National Life, inappropriate. So,
Chris Graff is very knowledgeable about Vermont politics. He's been following the state's political scene for close to 40 years now. So, I think that's a resource for the state.
Mm-hmm.
The other point I would make, though, is although I believe Shumlin will win, that doesn't necessarily mean I approve of Shumlin's performance as governor. As I've said to you and as I've said to other media people, I think there are many questions that need to be raised about Shumlin, and he has vulnerabilities in the area of transparency, in the area of economic performance over the last few years. I mean, again, now, someone may claim that what I'm going to say here is media bias, but VPR had an article on their website the other day fact-checking some of the claims that Shumlin and Scott Milne made about the Vermont economy in the debate on VPR last week. And the VPR article pointed out that Shumlin's claims, while not necessarily untrue, do involve, in a number of instances, stretching the facts about the performance of the Vermont economy over the last 4 years, the number of jobs, average incomes, and things like that. I think Shumlin deserves to be called out on things like that.
Mm-hmm.
His campaign, the campaign finance reports show that his organization is heavily dependent on contributions from businesses that are either regulated by the state, do business with the state, or are subsidized by the state. And again, I think there are issues there. It's interesting that those are the same sorts of criticisms of the campaign finance system that are being offered by Dean Corin, the progressive slash Democratic candidate for governor who has been endorsed by Shumlin.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are vulnerabilities and weaknesses in Shumlin, and I just don't see Scott Milne talking about them very, very much. I mean, Scott Milne argues that, you know, Vermont is not in very good shape. Well, okay, but what would he do differently? He has no plan about health care, as far as I can tell. For education, his plan, as he's mentioned in several appearances, is to freeze the property tax for 2 years. Well, okay, what's he going to do about education spending for 2 years? Is he going to freeze that? Does he have a way where health insurance rates for teachers and other school staff aren't going to go up over the next 2 years? Is the cost of fuel to heat school buildings not going to go up over the next 2 years? Where is the money going to come from to replace the property tax revenue if the property tax is frozen? He doesn't have any specifics about any issues like that.
Let's go to Brookfield. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. I think Eric's got some really good points here as far as, you know, the elucidation of the of the program to fix things from Scott Milne's point of view. There's an inevitability that comes with the Democratic Party in the state, and there's a lack of really rigorous intellectual debate about issues about how to fix things. I see signs. There's a gentleman running against Mark McDonald down in my town and for state senate, and that his signs say "fix it." Oh, great idea. But there's no silver bullets, as we all know. So where is the where's the concerted plan of the Republican Party or anybody else to fix what's really wrong with our government? All the points brought up about Health Connect, the lack of transparency, these are all really right out there for discussion. I think one other quick thing is that people tend to forget that, you know, they see an economist on the news, and economists and political pundits are about the same department as far as I'm concerned. Sorry, Eric, but the fact is that they're projections. When people speak of things as facts, as we know the economy will go up or down, or there'll be more jobs here or there, or this guy will win or that guy will win by that many a point, the fact is these are projections. And the American public, the consumers of this information, have to be intelligent enough to know that these are projections based on, you know, it's not scientific fact. It's not 1 + 1 = 2. It's a very complex, you know, there's pieces of it, I'm sure, Eric, that are intuitive. There's parts that are factual and data-driven. I'm sure it's a very complex series of data points that you go through in order to arrive at a position. And you know as well as I do that you're not always right. Nobody
Correct.
Is. And so the consumers have to be intelligent enough to know, okay, the economist said that we're going to, there was an economist on WCX about 3 or 4 years ago that made these wild projections, and the reporter on WCX did not ask him, well, how do you arrive at those? Just accepted that, said, that's great news. We're looking forward to that economic, you know, recovery that's so rampant that it's going to come back. Well, that person wasn't put to the rigorous questions. I think one of the good things you do, Mark, is you're willing to ask Eric, well, how did you get to that? And is that 10%, is that a good, you know, is that a good error rate? Or, you know, the questions that you're able to ask him are good. But we often accept things at face value because the person is a quote-unquote expert. We got to do some thinking for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's what it comes down to.
Let me have Eric comment on what you had to say. Thanks for your call, Tom.
Okay, I do appreciate that comment. And, yes, I mean, when I make a projection about an election, what I tend to look at are previous results for the same race, previous performance for the candidates in that race, the amount of money being raised, polling if there is any, the reaction to debates and other sorts of joint appearances, how the candidates other party how the party's other candidates are doing in other races, and if there are coattail effects and things like that. In terms of the Republicans and the difficulty they have coming up with policy ideas, I think that is a very serious problem. And, you know, there's an idea which I've had occasionally, which I think might work in Vermont, but would require a change in the way we do things. And that is, in larger states, certainly in Washington, the minority party is given staff, full-time, year-round staff. I mean, for example, right now in the House, you have a majority of Republicans. In the Senate, you have a majority of Democrats. But on every House committee, there's a minority staff, the Democratic staff, and they can do research and come up with proposals for the House Democrats. And the same thing for the Senate Republicans. We don't have that in Vermont. When you have an administration of one party and a legislature of the other, the administration can feed their supporters in the legislature policy ideas, even if they're in the minority. And that certainly happened when Jim Douglas was governor. Legislative Republicans would get ideas from the administration. But right now, the Republicans have no formal staff apparatus of any type. There's the Legislative Council in Montpelier, but that's sort of a nonpartisan group that works for the legislature as a whole, does bill drafting and things like that. And I know some Republicans wouldn't like this because it would mean spending some public money, but I think establishing small party staffs in the legislature to work year-round and work on developing policy ideas would not be a bad idea. We're not talking about huge groups of people, maybe 3 to 5 people for each of the two major political parties, and they have to figure out how the smaller parties would be supported here. But if there were 3 to 5 people in the quote-unquote minority staff in Montpelier who could work with Republican legislators on developing proposals on things like education, health care, economic development, energy policy, then at least the Republicans would have some well-thought-out policy proposals to present to the voters.
Mm-hmm. What's the dynamic you see going on in the lieutenant governor's race?
What I see there is, I would say, Phil Scott is ahead. He's the incumbent, and incumbents generally have advantages. Phil Scott is well-liked. He certainly is a vigorous campaigner and gets around the state. Corin has the Democratic endorsement, but interestingly, his name doesn't appear on the Democratic's mailers, and I don't think he's going to be included in their phone banking efforts either. And that has to do with a legal constraint, because he's receiving public financing, and I believe, well, I'm not positive on this, I believe that if the Democratic Party were to put Corin's name and face in their mailers, that could be considered an in-kind political contribution from the Democratic State Committee to the Corin campaign, which is not allowed under the terms of the public financing. I believe the only way Corin could get his name on the Democratic mailers would be to buy the space, pay the Democrats for the space and the postage. And I think he wants to focus mainly on broadcast ads. I would say at this point, Mark, Phil Scott is ahead. You know, I'm interested to see how well Corin does. Cassandra Gekas, who was an underfunded and little-known Democratic opponent, Scott 2 years ago got 40%. I'm interested to see whether Corin can do a little bit better than that, and you know, maybe get up into the mid 40s. But I would see at this point Phil Scott winning by 10% or perhaps somewhat more than that.
Let's go to Sheldon Ruth. Good morning.
Yes, I think our solution to the problem is to vote Peter Shumlin out of the governorship. You talk about money, and I think this election is going to boil down onto who has the money and who doesn't. And the voters don't have the money. They are really concerned about the bills that Montpelier is sending our way. And we don't have any money. They've squeezed everything out of us. They forced us out of business. They give all the benefits to their friends and cronies. And everybody is really scared. So I think it is going to be an issue of money. We don't have money to buy groceries, to pay for our gas, to heat our homes.
Let me interrupt and I want to get Eric to comment. The governor doesn't really seem to be talking much about this affordability or not.
No, I don't think he is, and I think it's a serious issue, and I don't think it's due only to taxes imposed by Montpelier, although that's part of it. I think it's part of the larger story, both nationally and statewide, about the stagnation of middle incomes in the United States, and that's been going on for the last 4 years since the financial crisis, that middle-class household incomes have not grown at all, even though expenses have grown, and that's a problem for incumbents. It's a problem for Shumlin. It's a problem for Obama. It's a problem for Republican incumbents in states where you have Republicans in office. The other thing, Mark, and I believe I've talked with you about this one too, is My sense, looking at some of the economic data that the state and the U.S. the department and other sources put out, is we see an increasing division in Vermont. I wouldn't go so far as to necessarily call it a two Vermonts, but I think we do see a division between a more prosperous Clinton County and other areas of northwestern Vermont and a more stagnant rest of the state. Job growth is faster in Chittenden County and surrounding areas like Franklin County, Lamoille County, and so forth. But in much of the state outside of the northwest quadrant, job growth is extremely slow, income growth is very low, population growth is non-existent, or in some instances, like in Rutland County, is even declining.
And I'm going to interrupt
you there.
Eric, I got to interrupt, but thanks. Have a great week, and I appreciate your time,
as
always.
All right, you too, Mark. My pleasure.
That's going to wrap things up for hour number one. We'll be back after the news.
AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley. The unemployment rate is down to